Last sugi that we studied was on Daf Tzadi Beis Amid Beis. The Gemara tried to bring a raya to Shita Shmuel that ain't holchem b'momen acharov against Rav from the Mishnah of Isha Yotzeis b'Numa in Ksubis. And the issue was whether or not she can collect a Ksuba of Masayim or only a Ksuba of Mona. And even though most women are married for the first time, they get Masayim, nevertheless the burden of proof is on her to prove that she was a Psula. And the reason for that is apparently Ein Holcha B'Momen Achar Harov. That was the Raya to Shitas Shmuel. Now, in general, the proof that she was a Psula at the time of the marriage would be Yotzeis B'Numa. She goes out with a veil. The word hinuma is miloshon linamnem, to sleep, to slumber, because she closes her eyes under the veil sometimes and she falls asleep. Nobody knows that. Also, Yotzeis b'Numa was another minhag that they had for a besula. They took her out from her father's rishus to the Beis HaChasnus, and her hair was left out wild. And the Gemara says that here the rov is not a strong rov, and even Rav would agree that you don't rely on this rov because there's a reus on the rov, and the reus on the rov is the fact that there's no kol. And in such a case, she has to bring edim to prove that she was indeed married as a besula. And it's quite possible that there was a very strong havamina here to assume that every woman that is married as a besula has a kol. And in the absence of a kol, we have definite proof that she was not a besula, and we wouldn't even believe the edim in such a case. But the Gemara answers, no, it's not all women have a kol. There are situations in which there's no kol, and therefore we could rely on the edim. This is all as far as her ability to collect haksuba with the chazaka of a besula, and she gets 200 zuz. The Gemara now goes on to try to prove Rav or Shmuel from a Mishnah with regard to a Mocher Eved. So we're in Daf Tzadi Beis Amid Beis, and we're starting here, Tashma, three lines up from the bottom, HaMocher Eved L'Chavero. So the buyer was surprised when he paid good money for this Eved, V'Nimtza Ganav, and it turns out that the Eved has a track record of being a thief. O Kubiustus. Here there's Machlokas, how to interpret the word Kubiustus. Most Rishonim say it's a kidnapper, and others say it means he's a Masachik Bekubia, it means he's a gambler. In any event, these kinds of defects with regard to an Eved were quite common, and it shouldn't have been a shock for the buyer to find out that his Eved is, is either a Ganav or a Kubiustus. And therefore, Higio means he's stuck with the sale. He cannot reverse and cancel the sale and claim Mekartos. However, in the case of, we're just on the last line of Tzadi Beis Amid Beis, we're about to start Tzadi Gimel Amid Aleph. If, on the other hand, we find out, lo and behold, list the mezuyon, that this Eved is an armed robber, you know, he comes to you with a gun in order to steal your money, he's a very dangerous thief, he's not just a thief, he's a robber, o muchtav l'malchus, or he's already been sentenced by the malchus to die, he's guilty of some crime, or at least so they accuse him, and the Malchus lets out a declaration that anyone who finds him should kill him. And basically, in this case, the Eved is considered like a dead man, because ultimately he's going to die. In such a case, Omer Lo, the buyer has a right to say to the seller, Harei Shel Chalafanecha, this is a real Mekartos, I didn't buy an Eved who's going to die. That's worthless. That's like buying an automobile without an engine in it. Now we'll see how the Gemara is going to analyze this brisa and how it sheds a light on the Machlokas Rav and Shmuel that we've been discussing. Reisha, and now we turn to Daf Tzadi Gimel Amud Aleph. Reisha, my timer, why is it that in the case where they find him to be a thief, in such a case the buyer, the lokeh, has no rights to cancel the agreement and violate and completely undermine the transaction, get his money back. Lav mishum, is it not because the ruba hachi isnahu, because most avodim have these defects, they're not trustworthy people. In those days the avodim used to hang around with the lower echelon of society, and therefore it's as if the lokeach, the buyer, had accepted upon himself to take this eved, purchase this eved, despite the fact that the eved has these defects and these drawbacks. And therefore the Gemara assumes that this would be a proof for the opinion of Rav. That means that the halacha, even in Dini Mominus, relies on Rav. Most people, when they buy an Eved, they buy an Eved with the understanding that he's not perfect. That's an understatement. And he has a defect. And that's why the Brisa says in the Reisha that the Lokeach has no recourse to cancel the transaction and get his money back and say, I don't want to buy this Eved, because most people under those circumstances would buy the Eved despite his defect. Now he, the buyer, claims, I wouldn't have bought this Eved had I known X, Y, and Z. But nevertheless, he's contradicted by a Rov, and the Halacha relies on Rov. This is going to be a difficulty according to Shmuel, because Shmuel says that in Dini Mominus we don't rely on Rov. Even though I have to tell you, Rabosai, that the Torah itself relies on Rov. The Torah says, Achri Rabim Lahatos, for example, when judges stand up to give their vote in any case so that there will be a verdict that's ruled by the Sanhedrin or by the Beis Din, the Torah says, account the Dayanim, and the Halacha is in favor of the Rov. And that applies even to Dinei Nefashos. We can put a person to death based on a condemnation of the Rov Dayanim. So shouldn't we say that there's a Kal v'chomer, much more so in Dinei Mominus, where no one's life is at stake? We should certainly rely on Rov. So the Mefarshim answer, I mean, this you'll find in Tosfos and Sanhedrin, that Rov has to be Isa Lekamon. It has to be something that we can count. We can take a look at the butcher shops and we can count them one by one. We can take a look at the Dayanim that are paskening and abased and we can count them. In such a case, that's called a Ruba the Isa Kamon, where we see it with our eyes. That's a reliable Rov. But in the case of most people who, let's say, buy an ox and they buy it for purposes of Harisha, not for Shechita, or for example, most people buy an Eved and they assume that there's going to be a defect, that kind of Rov is called a Ruba Delesa Kamon. It's some sort of an assumption about the way psychology, human psychology operates, but it's not something that's countable. And therefore the Kal v'chomer from Dini Nefashos is not, according to Shmuel, a valid Kal v'chomer. Rav, on the other hand, says that the Torah universally relies on Rov, even in Dinei Mominos. Now, Rabosai, if we had more time, but as you know, and Michael, you aren't here, but you know it anyway from my personality, I can't possibly say everything I have to say for you on a block Gemara in Bava Basra in 40 minutes, and especially when we start late. I was here on time, by the way. But in any event, Michael, you weren't here, but we decided we'll start at a quarter to. It's not negated to tomorrow. It's not negated to tomorrow, because yeah. Rabbi Weider, I think, is saying the Shia tomorrow. I'm assuming he's back in town.
He is.
Okay, great.
Same flight.
So the issue of starting at a quarter to seven is not relevant. You'll negotiate this with Rabbi Weider. I still think it's a good idea to start at a quarter to seven. But be that as it may, at this particular juncture, we would have a half-hour discussion on what the Gemara is thinking here. Because offhand, this analogy of the Gemara between the Brice of Eved and the Machlokas between Rav and Shmuel is completely off base. And I'll tell you why. Because the Machlokas between Rav and Shmuel is about the power of possession, which means Chezkas Mamon. And Rav wants to establish that Rov is so powerful that it can be Motzi Mamon Mechezkaso, could even undermine the power of a Chazaka. This case of Eved, Lechora, is operating in the exact opposite direction, because it's the Mocher who's holding on to the Mos, correct? And now the buyer comes along and he says, well, I want those mos back. And we're going to say that because of the rov, the mocher is going to be able to hold on to the mammon, his mos that he got paid for the eved. He doesn't have to return them. In this case, the rov is actually supporting the position of the muchzak, That's not what Rav is talking about. Rav is talking about a position where you have a conflict between the Rov and the Muksa. Because as I said, that's not for a blotch here on a Daf Yomi basis. No, anyway. Why does it have to? You're probably right, but I'm just wondering why couldn't it not be an Eved Ivri? Yeah, because an Eved Ivri would not be a thief. Exactly. Right. We're talking about an Eved Kanani, right. You're right. I'm sorry, I missed that point. So Gemara says, "Lo, this is not a proof against Shmuel. Kulu hachi isnahu," meaning that even Shmuel would agree in this case. That the reason here that underlies this price is not because Rov Avodim, but rather Kulu Hachi Isnahu. This is the Gemara is going out on a limb, and the Gemara is going as far as to say that every single Eved, so to speak, again, maybe it's 99%, but there's no Miud Hanikar here, every Eved is a thief, is unreliable, and he steals from time to time. That's the nature of an Eved. And therefore, it's as if the Mocher had said to the Lokeach explicitly, outright, from the get-go, that this Eved is going to be a thief. Don't be surprised. Buy the Eved knowing full well that it has a blemish. Moshel amat over dome. Let's say, for example, I sell a cow, and the cow has a scar across its back, and it's obvious, it's nikar, it's visible to the eye. In such a case, the Lokeach has no recourse to claim, I want my money back because I didn't buy a hinkadika cow, you know, that slips a little bit here or there. Well, it was obvious to you, and this was almost explicit in the contract, that I'm selling you an object with the following drawbacks or defects. In the case of an Eved, Kulu Islu, every Eved has the drawback, and therefore it's not an issue of Rov. Even Shmuel agrees that if the case is that of certainty, we rely on that premise. Toshma, now we have another Raya, and this is going to again support the Shita, not of Rav in this case, but like the earlier Rayas that we brought of Shmuel. And this is based on a very, very famous Mishnah in Masechet Bava Kamma on Daf Mem Vav. This is perhaps one of the most famous Mishnais in all of Seder Nezikin. And what does it say in the Mishnah? Shor shenogach hasapara v'nimtza ubra b'tzida. So Reuven's ox gores Shimon's cow. Okay, the cow is dead. But not only that, the cow is pregnant. And the fetus of the cow, the calf, the future calf, was also killed in... Now, we don't know exactly how it was killed. The Eino Yodua, it's not public knowledge. Im, is it the following? Ad Shalom Nogcha Yolda, perhaps the Ubar, the fetus, was born before the Negicha, before the goring, which in which case the goring had nothing to do with the death of the calf, and therefore the owner of the goring ox, in this case Reuven, has no responsibility. There's no liability on his part. He was not, or his, I should say his ox, Reuven's ox, was not responsible for the death of Shimon's Ubar, because the Ubar was born naturally and then died. Again, you and I might think on the side, by the way, can't we tell from the nature of the animal? Aren't there simonim, as we'd say, in the nature of the animal that you can see exactly how it died? You know, we'll send it to forensic laboratory testing. But right now, the Gemara assumes we have no way of knowing what brought about the death of the Ubar. Oh, the other possibility is a Mishen Nogcha Yolda, that after the Negicha, and as a result of the goring, the Vlad was killed, and therefore he should be paying. Basically what we have here is the famous machlokas between Sumchus and the Chachamim about what's called Maman Amut al Besafik, which means that we have no clue what exactly transpired here. And there are two possibilities, and they're both logically compelling. And in such a case, Sumchus says, Yachloku, we divide up the money. And this mission, as we'll soon see, reflects the sheet of Sumchus against the Chachamim. The Chachamim say that possession is 9/10 of the law, and Amotzi Mechavel of Araya. And therefore, we're not going to allow the Motzi to take any money whatsoever out of the possession of the Muchsak. But this Mishnah in Shor Shenogach HaSapara reflects the Shita of Sumchus, Yachloku. Now keep in mind, the Shor here that's owned by Reuven is a Shor tam, which means the maximum liability he has is only chatzi nezek. If we're going to apply the principle of yachloku, so we take the chatzi nezek. If we were certain that he, Reuven, was responsible for this damage, he would pay chatzi nezek. In this case, we take the chatzi nezek and split it in two. Half of a half is how much? A quarter, correct? So, Mashalim Chatzi Nezek LePara. We know without any doubt that the Shar killed the Parah. For that, he has to pay Chatzi Nezek because he owns a Shar Tam. But with regard to the Ubar, Urevia LeVlad, and he pays one quarter with regard to the Vlad. Again, it's not clear to me why the Mishnah opens up with the word Ubar and ends up with the word Vlad. But anyway, for our purposes, they are synonymous. So the Gemara now asks a question, according to Rav Amai, I have a strong Rov to support the position of the Nizak. Why? The Amai, why do we say that this is Safek? And therefore Yachloku, Lema, why don't we say Halach Acha Rov Paros? Let's look at the nature of cows. The rov paros, in most cases, misavros v'yoldos. When they become pregnant, they ultimately give birth. V'ha, and in this case, what should we say based on this rov? Vadai machmas negicha hipila. To tell me that the cow gave birth to a stillborn, that's called a hapola, and therefore the negicha had nothing whatsoever to do with the death of the fetus, that's far out. That's uncommon. More likely, more reasonable, is to assume that the cow would have given birth to a normal Vlad. The Vlad would not have died for any number of unforeseen reasons, or would have been born as a stillborn, but rather it was killed as a result of the impact of the negich of the goring. It's like a car that all of a sudden falls apart and it's smashed up, so why, all of a sudden the car died of old age? Probably there was an impact and some sort of a collision. So therefore, the principle here should be, according to Rav, Azlinan Basa Ruba. And since Rav would tell me that the fetus certainly died, well, I shouldn't say certainly, but most likely died as a result of the impact of the goring, therefore, the owner of the Shar HaMazik, meaning Reuven in this case, should be liable to pay Chatzi Nezek. Elomai, we have to assume, like Shmuel, that ain't olchim b'momen achar rov, that despite this rov, we are going to protect the muchzak, in this case the Reuven, the owner of the ox, and we're going to say he doesn't have to pay the full damage, which means chatzi nezek in this case, but rather he pays half. So the Gemara answers, no, this is not a proof for Shmuel. Why? Hasam mishum de mesafkel. We have a bona fide suffix. This is not a reliable rov. And therefore, Maman Amutal B'Safik Cholkin according to Sumchus. The Ikol and Meimar, because to the same extent that we could say, A, this is possibility number one, Mekama Asa, the Shar, the damaging ox, came in front of the cow, the pregnant cow. There was an eye-to-eye confrontation over here. Umi bi usa, mi bi isusa, hipila. It could be that in this case, although most cows come to full term until they give birth to the ubar, here it was a premature birth. And why? Because the cow was overwhelmed by fear. Imagine this big, burly, angry, aggressive ox looks the cow in the face and is about to jump on the cow. Then certainly the cow is going to be very shooken up. It's about to be killed. And the shar now, and the parah, excuse me, now prematurely gives birth to the vlad. But ikol ameimer, it's possible. Me'achora also. Maybe the shar ha nogeah came from the back. And there was never an eye-to-eye contact in which the parah saw the negich. It was taken totally by surprise. And therefore, maybe the negich of ipila. And then we're going to assume that maybe this is one of those rare exceptional cases in which the cow gave birth prematurely to this ubar, to this fetus, and the fetus died a natural death and not as a result of the cause of the goring.
But in both cases, it's the bull's fault.
Well, again, it doesn't matter whose fault it is. It matters what caused the death of the fetus. The owner of the cow, the owner of the ox, is definitely at fault, and he's going to pay, again, in quotation marks, full damages for the death of the cow. But if you can ask me about the ubar, what caused the death of the ubar? We think that the ubar was killed as a result of the impact of the goring. Well, that might not be the case at all. It could very well be that the reason why the cow gave birth prematurely is not because of the impact. Now, Michael, keep in mind, there are two ways in which the ubar could have died. One way is called impact. If it's impact, that's called negicha, and the shor hamazik has to pay damages for that. There's another way, and that's called bi'isusa. Bi'isusa comes under the halacha of grama b'nezikin. And this is a sugya in Bava Kama, and the Gemara says that if I scare you and I cause you damages as a result of some sort of sudden shock, that's grama b'nezikin. I cannot be held liable for that.
So the scaring caused the hapalah.
Correct. If the scare caused the hapalah, not the collision, not the impact, then we apply the principle of grama b'nezikin patur, and therefore Reuven, the owner of the ox, doesn't have to pay damages at all for the loss of this ubar. If, on the other hand, it was the impact of the negicha, the cow did not even see the eyes of the shor hamazik, shor hanogeach, but rather it came from the back, and therefore it was, the ubar was killed by impact, then the negicha was not just related to the cow, the mother, but also to the vlad. And at the end of the day, since we don't know exactly what happened, we have no witnesses, did the shor come from the front or from the back, havi momen amutul besafek v'chol momen amutul besafek cholkin, because this Mishnah reflects the shita of Sumchus.
So why did we get your quarter?
Just 1 second, I'll be with you in a second, David. I'm sorry, I just wanted to clear my head on one point here. Oh, but in the case where I sold you a shor, and it turned out that the shor was a nagchan, and it turns out that unbeknown to you, this shor was a nagchan, it was a goring, aggressive shor, af l'sumchus, even sumchus would agree in such a case, that hamotzi mechavero olav haraya. And therefore, Shmuel would say, ein holchim b'mom nacharov. Yeah, go ahead, David. I wanted to...
So the quarter, as opposed to a half.
Right.
So it's a short tongue. So you pay a half.
Right, the maximum is half.
Of course you pay a half of
whatever you would normally pay if we were vada, and half of a half is a quarter. Lema ketanoi, the Gemara suggests that maybe the machlokes on this fundamental issue of whether holchim b'mom nacharov or ein holchim b'mom nacharov is indeed a machlokes tanoim. Now, if there's a machlokes tanoim, which means we're going to do what I call the matching deal, that puts either Shmuel or Rav, either one, in a sort of weak position, because Rav is convinced that everybody would maintain the power of Rov, even in Dini Momonos, and Shmuel would say that nobody would maintain the power of Rov against Cheskas Momon. So what the Gemara is going to do, and this is such a classical structure in the Talmud, is to first present what they think is the simple pshat, namely the Machlokas Tanoim, and Rav and Shmuel each hold like one of those two Tanoim respectively, and then the Gemara is going to say, no, this case is not analogous, and therefore Rav could hold like everyone, and he's going to interpret the Brayse in the light of his Shita, and Shmuel could hold like everyone. What's the deal in this Brayse? Shor Shahaya Roa. Now, what this means is that, by the way, just on the previous Gemara, I know this is suicidal on my part, but I just want to say the previous Gemara, if you take a look carefully at the Lashon HaMishnah, the Mishnah says, the Eino Yadua. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Oh, the Eino Yadua. And the Rishonim HaMedayik, it doesn't say Eino Yodea, it says Eino Yadua. What Eino Yadua means is we, Bezdin, don't know. We have no evidence. The implication is that there is someone who knows. And what does that mean? That both the owner of the ox, who's the nitba, and the owner of the cow, who's the tovea, they do know. What does that mean, they do know? That's called bari ubari. Because this mission of Sumchus, of Yachloku, is based on bari ubari. And it could very well be that the law would change if it's Eina Yodea, which means that even if the tovea and the nitba don't know. Okay, just on the side. In any event, shar shahaya roeh. Now, if a shar is in pasture, then the assumption is that there's good grazing land. And if there's good grazing land to be had, probably there are other shvarim as well. That's not the only sole, what do you call, lone ox. It's not the lone ox. V'nimtza shar harug b'tzido. And now, right next to this shar, in close proximity, we find Nebuch a gishtar ben ashar, a dead shar. It's afalpi shezeh. What's the next word, please? Because it didn't come out of my photocopy here.
Minugach.
Oh, minugach means that when we look at the dead shar, it's minugach. Means it, there are clear indications that it died as a result of this goring. Oh, if that be the case, then l'chora we should certainly hold the owner of the live shar responsible for damages. Okay, let's go through all the cases and then we'll try to clarify why. Vizeh muad ligach. Let's add another circumstantial evidence into the equation, and that is that the shar that's alive is a shar naghan that's proved itself on three occasions. That's called huad bebezden al yidei shalosh negichos, which you learned already back in the third parak of Bava Basra at the beginning of Chesk Sabbatim, because from those three negichos the Gemara derives three shanim in chazok, if you remember. Or the Brice gives another case, and in this case it says zem minushach. This is even a stronger evidence that the live shar was responsible for the death of the dead shar. There are actual marks in the body of the deceased. This is what I speak about before forensic medicine, that it was attacked. Minushach means it was bitten, and it died as a result of that. V'zeh mu'ad lishach. Okay, this you have to know a lot about shar mu'ad. Because shar mu'ad, there are different types of negicha, negifa, and this way and that way. In this case, there's something called neshicha. Neshicha is a tolda of Karen. Okay, that's not for us now. That's the beginning of a sect above Kam. But in any event, this shar is clearly a noshech. You know, he's a biter. You know, when you raise little children, you have different kinds of mischievous children. You have nagchanim, and then you have noshchim. You know, when the child starts biting others, then you're in trouble. Then,
I'm not sure what the difference is. If you, in the first case, you've got a shor muad, and the dead ox has been gored. In the second case, you've got a shor menushach, and the ox has been bitten.
So there's even greater evidence.
Why is it greater?
Because even if the shor is menugach, okay, we may have other shvarim in the pasture land to blame this on, but in the case of menushach, where are the other shvarim that are nakhanim, meaning muadim l'neshicha? In other words, what the Bryce wants to do is pump up the evidence here against the shor hamuad, to assume that the Shabud was responsible for the death. And now we get the bomb, now we get the chiddush of this brisa. Ein omrim, we don't say, as you and I probably would have said, based on all the circumstantial evidence, biyadua, we know, right, based on our investigation and circumstantial, shezen nagcho, vizen eshacho, whether this one here was the one who gored, or this one was responsible for the neshicha. And therefore, the owner of the shar that's still alive doesn't have to pay damages. And this brisa continues. It doesn't stop here. It quotes now another Tana. And this Tana is Rav Acha. Rav Acha Omer. Rav Acha is of the opinion that what? Here, I'll just read to you this footnote. He says, Hainu, Kevan Sharon Bo Simon Maka is Yeshlan Ulukhoro Litlos Shemes Machmasamaka. And he says, Vekolshkin, and how much more so if we have simonim of neshicha? That's even a more rare kind of death. So you can't tell me that this animal happened to just drop dead of old age. Okay. Rabbi Acha Omer. Now Rabbi Acha is a Tana who argues against the Tanakama. And here's where we're going to get a Tlia, you know, an interdependence of Machlokas Rav and Shmuel on these two Tanas. Gomel, we're talking about a camel. Ha'ocher bein hagmalim. Okay, now what does the word ocher mean? Here we have a machlokas, how to interpret ocher. According to one school of thought, ocher means, and that's how the Rashbam learns it, that he's in the mating season. According to another pshat, which is the Yad Ramah and other Rishonim, Chachmei Sfarad, they want to claim that the word ocher means he's in a wild state. He's very agitated, this camel. Don't go near this camel. He's kicking up a storm. And even though there are other gemalim around, only this gemal is an ocher. V'nimtza gemal harug b'tzido. And we find another camel that's dead right next to it. Bi'adua, we know shezeh hargo, that this ocher was responsible for the death of the dead, deceased camel. And that's called chazaka, meaning we have circumstantial evidence. Says Rabbi Acha, in such a case, we can hold the ocher, the owner of the gamal ha-ocher, liable for damages. Savrua. Now, what the Gemara thinks at this particular point is the ruba of a chazaka ki hadadi ninhu. Meaning the chazaka that this animal, which is an ocher, is the same as rov. What does that mean? Rov is a statistical probability that's based on the general psychology of human behavior. Chazaka means circumstantial evidence that weighs in very heavily, and basically the Gemara says that also produces a statistical probability. What difference, again, if we were in college taking statistics 101, we would probably have a lot to say about this equation. But the Gemara right now assumes that statistical probability could be created by one of two things. Either by the general behavior pattern out there in the marketplace, which Rav says that when you buy an ox, you usually buy an ox for charisha and not for shechita, not for its meat. And chazaka, which means that the circumstances seem to indicate very, very clearly that this is what happened. We missed, you know, we don't have the videotape to see that this gamal ha'ocher actually killed the other gamal, but based on the circumstances, we can conclude that in all likelihood, it's reasonable to assume that this gamal killed this gamal. And if that be the case, the Gemara says, this issue should be dependent upon the machlokas Shin Rav and Shmuel. Can we force the owner of the live camel to pay damages against his chazaka based on a rov, or in this case an umduna, circumstantial evidence which is like a rov? And therefore, lema, we should assume that Rav Diomar Kirav Acha, Rav represents an application of the principle of Rabbi Acha, that indeed you pay damages because during the mating season this camel is going to go wild, and that's chazok. And if a rov equals chazok and vice versa, and based on that equation, Rabbi Acha, and therefore Rav, comes to the conclusion that you can force someone to pay, and in the case of the mocher, he's going to have to return the most that he received as purchase for the sale of this shar, which is only as a nagchan, is only royal shechita. Just like Rabbi Acha says that you can force the owner of the camel to pay damages; he's liable for the death of the other camel. Ushmuel diomer kitanakama, but the Tanakama says that despite the chazaka and all the circumstantial evidence that clearly indicates that this camel killed this camel, nevertheless, there's no liability, no payment for damages. Why? Because we're not going to rely on chazaka, and who I did in the Gemara thinks we're not going to rely on rov, and that reflects the shita of Shmuel of Ein Holkum Rov.
So, sorry, does Rav Acha agree with the ox that bit the other ox? Would he say that's chazaka?
For sure, absolutely.
Right.
Rav Acha wanted to go even a step further, and he told me that even in the case of Gomel HaOcher, which again, you don't know 100% sure about a Gabala Ocher, even that case is sufficient for circumstantial evidence to find the owner of the live cow liable. So the Gemara says, no, Rav is going to work out even according to Tanakama, Shmuel is going to work out even according to Rabbi Acha. How does that go? Rav would say, I hold a filu l'tanakama, I can reconcile myself even with the Tanakama. And now Rav is going to differentiate between Rov and Chazaka, even though, as we said before, they both seem very similar. Ad kan lo kamar Tanakama hosam. Why does the Tanakama alleviate the owner of the camel of his responsibility? Elab, what's the reason for that? Delo azlin and basa chazaka, because chazaka is not strong enough to allow someone to collect damages. Aval basa ruba, but in the case of a rov azlin on, we do rely on rov even according to the Tanakama, like my shita says Rav. In other words, rov is stronger than chazaka. And why is that so? And the answer, I believe, is because in the case of Chazaka, you really have no evidence as to what happened in this particular case. You just have a general assumption based on circumstantial evidence. Rove, on the other hand, tells me something about this particular piece of meat. I find a piece of meat in the street. The Torah tells me that rely on Rove to determine what the nature and the identity of that meat is. The shar, what was the nature of the shar that was included in the sale? Most people, when a shar is sold, forget about most people, let me start the sentence again. Most shvarim, most oxen out there on the market are sold for the purpose of harisha. Again, I'm not going to go into the issue that we discussed yesterday, domim mochichim, it's a different price, why doesn't that prove it? Leave all that out. But in pure theory, Rav says that the Rov tells me that this shar that's being sold now belongs to the Rov. Imagine there's 100 shvarim out there in the market. 70 out of 100 shvarim are sold for the purpose of Harisha. Only 30 out of 100 are sold for the purpose of Shechita. This shar that's being sold now, the Rov tells me that it comes from the Rov. This comes from the 70% of the oxen. That's not circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is something very general. Here, we're talking about a particular item or object that came out of the rove. And that's stronger, even the Tanakhama would accept it. Shmuel, Amar Lecha, Shmuel is going to tell you, Ana di'amri afilu l'Rabbi Acha, I can reconcile myself even with a sheet of Rabbi Acha who finds him, the owner of the camel, liable. Ad kan lo kamar bachas hasam el dazlin and basar chazaka. When does Rabbi Acha rely on circumstantial evidence that's in a chazaka? Why? To hu gufe muchzak. Because chazaka in this case tells me something about this particular camel. This camel is a killer camel. Why? Because it's in a temporary state of anger, of, you know, he wants to, in the mating season, I mean, Brian, you're the expert on this, but I think you'll tell me that, you know, you don't allow other, you know, males, you know, anywhere around, you know, saying, you know, this is, or for example, if they attack a cub, you know, forget it, you know, don't go near a bear that has a cub, right? So here we're saying something about this particular camel and its psychology. However, Aval, in the case of, where am I? No, I think I skipped a page here. Here it is. Okay. Aval basaruba lo azrinan, but Rabbi Acha would agree that you can't force someone to pay based on a rove, meaning a rove here is considered something statistical, and it doesn't really reflect on this particular shard that's being sold. You know, you're not telling me anything about the nature and the psychology of this shard. Toshma, trying to move at the speed of light here. Hamocher peros lechavero. A person sells, this is our Mishnah, on Daf Tzadi Alf. Somebody sold fruits, uzron, and the lokeach thought that, you know, these fruits have seeds which can be sown, that can be planted, lizria, and that's even better for him, more beneficial. V'lo tzomcha, but to his chagrin, they did not produce In other words, they didn't grow, they didn't take. Vafilu zera pishtan. We spoke about zera pishtan, that in most cases, that when you buy zera pishtan, they weren't into health foods of eating flax seeds. They took flax seeds and they planted it in order to produce flax. And lo and behold, he plants this flax seeds and nothing takes. Eino chayev b'achar yuson. The mocher does not have to return and reimburse the lokeach. Says the Gemara, Maya filu, what was this chiddush that the Tanakhama added here? That even though it's zera pishton, the answer is la. Maya filu lav, shouldn't we sue afilu zera pishton? Derubal isria zvine, zavne, that in most cases when a person buys flax seeds, he buys for the purpose of zria. Vafilu hachi, and nevertheless lo azrin and basa ruba. This is clearly against the shita of Rav. And at this point, Rav is really in deep quagmire. You know, he's really deep in the butts, as we say in Hebrew. You know, in Yiddish you say blot arayin. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with those phrases. Okay. So in any event, the Gemara at this point raises its hands and says, you know what? Rav is definitely against our Mishnah. But the ball game is not lost. And why is that? Tanoihi. Because Rav does have another Tana to rely on. That this issue of Rav and Shmuel about Hazlina Bas Rubi is Machlokas Tanoim. This Sanya, because we have a Braisa that says, Hamocher Peros Lechavero, if a person sells produce, Uzron, and the buyer plants them, Velot Samchu, and they didn't take. Zarune Gina, She'enam ne'echolim, or alternatively, if we're talking about Zarune Gina, if you remember on both sides, Zarune Gina are not royal achil, they're only royal Israel. And he planted these garden seeds, and what did he get? Zilch. Is chayev bachra yusam. He has to pay, meaning the mocher has to return the money.
That's because it's 100%, not
right. Right? Zera pishton. Ain't no chayev bachra yuson, but according to Tanakam, in the case of Pishton, where we said there are people who eat flax seeds, albeit the minority, the silent minority, is Rav Yossi Omer. Rav Yossi says here on Tzadi Gimel, Amid Beis, no same lo to me zera. The owner, I'm sorry, the seller has to pay and reimburse the buyer. And why is that? Because of Rov, because in the case of Zera Pishton, as we said before, most people will buy flax seeds for purpose of Zriah, and here it was a dud, and therefore he gets his money back. His dog, clearly Rav Yossi maintains the sheet of Rav, as implies in the case of flax seeds, that we rely on Rav, even if it means that the mocha is going to have to cough over the money. Amrulo, again, now this is a big question, who's Amrulo? And Tosfos points out that generally in Shas, when it says Amrulo, it's a reference to Rabbi Nosson. Here the Gemara is going to identify Amrulo as Rav Shimon Gamliel. But in any event, Harbe Lokhin Oso Lidvarim Acherim. There are people who buy flax seeds for other purposes. It's used, the Rashbam says, it's used sometimes as a refuah and even sometimes as a nechal. So what's going on? So Mantan, okay, we have 3 more minutes and we'll see how far we can get in those 3 minutes. Which Tana of Mantanoi, excuse me, when you set up this Machlokas Tanoim as the equivalent to Machlokas Rav and Shmuel, how do you line it up? Ilema Rav Yossi vi Amrulo. If you're going to tell me that what I had in mind when I brought you this Braisa is the Machlokas Rav Yossi and the Amrulo, no. Travayu basa ruba azli. Both Rabbi Yossi and the quote unquote Amrulo both adopt the position of Rav that azlin and basa ruba. But there's an inner machlokas as to what is the Rav. Mar azel basa ruba di inchi. Umar azel basa ruba tizria. And first, the Gemara presents the sheet of the Amrulo. According to the Amrulo, what we look at, what we analyze is ruba de inchi. Most people out there will buy very limited quantities of flax seeds for medicinal purposes, for eating purposes. But when you get to the real farmers, again, they buy massive amounts of flax seeds. They will purchase this for the purpose of planting. So according to the Amrulo, let's look at ruba de inchi. So out of 100 people who are buying flax seeds, 80 out of 100 will buy them for eating purposes and not for planting purposes. Umar Azil, but Rabbi Yossi holds that we go busser a different rov. Which rov is going to determine? Ruba Dizria. Look at the seeds themselves, and if you take the quantity of seeds out there in the market, the majority of quantity of seeds, the greater larger quantity, is purchased for the purpose of Zriya. So the question is, this is what we call Gavra Hefta, meaning, do we look at the people, the buyers, or do we look at the item, the Hefta, the object? Ella, says the Gemara, Itanakama Virab Yossi. What we should really assume are the following two possibilities: that the machlokas Rav and Shmuel is either the machlokas between the Tanakama of this Braisa and Rav Yossi, because the Tanakama says that the buyer has no recourse to get his money back from the seller, because Ein Holchim B'Mamon Achar Rov, even though most people would have bought flax seeds for purpose of Achila, I'm sorry, for Zriya. And Rabbi Yossi is of the opinion that the mocher will have to pay back the money because we rely on rov. Itanakama v'omrulo. Alternatively, it's the machlokas between the Tanakama and the Omrulo, because again, the Omrulo also adopts the position of rov, and in Didi Mominus we rely on rov. Just as the Tanakama, the Omrulo have a different rov here. They look at the rov, not of the seeds, but the rov of the buyers. And in any event, Rav is not out in the cold, he's not sleeping in the doghouse, pardon the phrase, because Rav could rely either on Rabbi Yossi or Amrulo, either way, because both Rabbi Yossi and Amrulo agree that the halacha relies on Rav, and the Tanakama rejects Rav in Dini Mominus like Shmuel. So that's the Lema Kitanoi. If you don't mind, repeat what you said. I didn't catch.
You said that the seller and the buyer definitely know what happened. It's a big deal if they don't know. What's the Havamina?
Oh, so the question is, this is the sugya in Shoshanoka Sapporah, Bava Kama Memvav. How far does Sumchus go when he says Yachloku? Would Sumchus apply the principle of Yachloku even in Shema Veshema? Or only in Bari Ubari? Because after all, Shmuel, as opposed to the Chachamim, says that we can't be Motzi Mamon when there's an objective suffix out there. We don't know what happened. You know, did the Uber die as a result of the impact of the Sharm Nogeach? Or it died a natural death? So in that case, Sumcha says, let him pay damages. Why? Because we split it in half. So the Gemara raises the possibility that that's only because it's a Tainus Bari. I, as the owner of the cow, come to you as the owner of the ox, and I say to you, I know that it was your ox that killed my ubar, my fetus. Then I have a tainus bari. Oh, and a tainus bari, together with the fact that the objective facts on the ground are unknown, when we add that and calculate all that together, you have to pay half. That's the sheet of simples. But if the owner of the cow himself, he wasn't there, he wasn't affinart, as we say, on the spot, he has no clue exactly what was responsible for the death of the fetus. In such a case, even Sumchus might agree that he doesn't have recourse to force the owner of the ox to pay damages. So the Rishonim come and say that that's what Medayik, because it says v'lo yodua. Why didn't it say v'lo yodea? That would have been a bigger kiddush to tell me that even though he's unaware of what went on, he wasn't on the spot, nevertheless he can force him to pay at least a revere, one quarter, and we activate the principle of Sumchus Mamon Amuto V'Safik Cholkin. The answer is that the Mishnah went out of its way to say V'lo Yadua. We don't know.
Only the Bezdin doesn't know.
But the Bezdin doesn't know. They don't have any evidence, no anything. But he, meaning the owner of the cow, he knows, because he was there, you know, he was looking with his binoculars and he saw that the impact of the goring of the ox was responsible for the death not only of his cow, the mother cow, but even of the...
But goring means the owner of the goring ox would say, no, I know for sure my cow...
Correct. Then you have a situation of bari ubari, you have an objective suffix which is called, I don't know if you're familiar with terminology, dror de mamona. That's when Sumchus presses the button of Yachlor. And that's why the Gemara wants to suggest that Yachloku at the beginning of Bava Metzia of Shnei Mochus Metalis is not Sumchus. Why? Because Sumchus is talking about a case where we have an objective suffix. We really don't know what happened. But in the case of Shnei Mochus Metalis, we don't have an objective suffix. This guy's claiming it's my talis. This guy's claiming it's my talis. They both say that they picked it up. I got there first, you grabbed it from me. Sunkus would agree in that case that the normal halacha of Bavan Amutu B'Safek might not apply. Again, that's the sugya at the beginning of Bavan
Amutu B'Safek. But Bari means someone has to be lying, or else mistaken.
Correct. In Bari Bari there's a Vare Shachar. And that again is another sugya at the beginning of Bavan Amutu B'Safek, that perhaps we don't impose a Shmua when there's a Vare Shachar. And the surprising thing is that the Mishnah at the beginning of Bavan Amutu B'Safek says that Shnayim Oksim Talmid, each one takes a Shmua. Now, if each one takes a shmur, one of them is definitely lying, that's a problem.
But he doesn't shmur, know he's lying. He believes he's right.
Ah, so maybe the Gemara says that he made a mistake. In other words, he thought he grabbed the towels first. Okay, so for that you have to learn about mitzvah.
Thank you.
Tana Rabbanan, the Gemara now addresses itself to a whole different issue and quotes a brisa. What is it in the case where the seller is responsible, let's say for example Zaroni Gino, where everybody agrees that he definitely was selling Zaroni Gino for purposes of Zriya, and the buyer was certainly buying it for purposes of Zriya, and it turns out that it was defective. Now keep in mind that the buyer in this case spent a lot of time, effort, and even money in planting these defective garden seeds. And the Brisa wants to know Mao no say lo. In other words, when the mocher has to reimburse the lokeach because he sold him defective property, in this case seeds, is dmei zera v'lo hotza v'yesh omer maf hotza. Perhaps the seller can sue the buyer. I'm sorry, perhaps the buyer can sue the seller not only to get his money back for the mekartos, the sale, but also for damages. You caused me a tremendous loss by selling me these defective seeds. And the Yesh Omrim in fact says afotza, that you can expect that the mocher has to reimburse the lokeach, number one, and on top to boot, he's got to pay him for damages. And this would seem to indicate that according to the Yesh Omrim, Groma ben Ezekin is Chayav. Man Yesh Omrim, Omer Rav Chizda, Rav Shimon Gamliel, who and now the Gemara is going to proceed to try to analyze who is Rav Shimon Gamliel in this case. I don't mean who he is, but where do we find Rav Shimon Gamliel who says that Yechayev to pay even for Groma ben Ezekin for indirect cause without a Maisa Mas. Okay, so we'll stop here.